Yes, we do hope to see you there. It's our first pop-up stories at the Broad, and hopefully not our last. Join us tomorrow, or no, it's not tomorrow evening, it's Thursday evening. Join us Thursday evening between 6 and 7:30 at the Broad. Pop-up stories, your lucky break. I'm Mark Bayshore. Welcome back to Current State here for Tuesday, the 22nd day of March. At the top of our program, members of the Lansing City Council have been trying to learn more about how a $160,000 severance agreement was granted to recently departed City Attorney Janine McIntyre. Well, for well over an hour last evening, the council questioned a high-ranking member of Mayor Virge Bernero's administration about that deal. To learn what came out of that meeting, we welcome back to Current State City Council Member Jody Washington. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Mark. Nice to be here.
Thank you for joining us. The mayor's chief of staff, Randy Hannon, answered your questions last night. Where do we stand? Is any more known about how Janine McIntyre's severance was negotiated?
Randy Hannon didn't answer any of our questions last night. It was well over an hour of double talk, and what we were told is we can't talk about it. But what was really interesting, Mark, is, you know, through the process and even last night, we were told as a council, well, she was your employee too, and it was your responsibility to find out what was going on. And it makes it really difficult to do that when you are under the belief that everything is fine and you have no idea that these secret negotiations are going on behind the back door. So now that they have come to this settlement agreement with Ms. McIntyre, in the 14th paragraph, there's a clause that says they will not talk about it, and there's a $10,000 fine if the employee or the employer discusses this contract. So now that it's been done without any knowledge from counsel, nobody can talk about it. So as we ask questions, we're told we can't talk about it. So, you know, basically Randy wanted it both ways, as did the mayor. She's your employee. You should have looked into it. Oh, sorry, we negotiated the settlement agreement. We can't talk about it. So the shroud of secrecy is what begs the question, and I asked it last night, what are you hiding?
And to that he responded what?
With silence.
Literally?
Yes.
No response at all to
None.
Your question, what are you hiding?
Nothing.
Talk to us about the city council members' efforts to try to contact Janine McIntyre directly. I take it there's been some kind of effort along that way. Has no one on the city council been able to actually contact her?
I cannot speak for my colleagues. I have not attempted to contact Ms. McIntyre because actually when this all occurred, I was out of the country. But I did keep in touch and I did keep myself informed as to what was going on. And by the time we knew anything, Mark, this settlement agreement had been negotiated with the clause of silence. So there would be no point in contacting her because she's prohibited to talk about it. And her attorney has made no comment because he too cannot talk about what brought this forward. Now you have to understand her contract was signed, I believe, forgive me if I get it wrong a little bit, I believe the end of December. And then by February, this whole negotiation had happened to pay her $166,000 for her settlement agreement. This isn't a severance package. This is a settlement agreement, which is quite different than your average severance package.
Well, both sides, a settlement, I mean, this just begs all kinds of questions.
Of course.
But both sides in this had legal representation.
Yes.
How significant is that?
To me, it's very significant. Why would the city of Lansing need to hire counsel for what they called a voluntary resignation for her to pursue other opportunities? And why is there this shroud of secrecy for something that should have been what they deemed to be a voluntary resignation? Mm. And clearly you have to, I mean, I don't think it takes a Phi Beta Kappa to figure it out that we paid her. She didn't pay us.
Do you think something unethical happened?
I absolutely
that,
do.
That gave Ms. McIntyre the upper hand and enabled her to obtain a sweetheart?
I have no proof, but I absolutely believe that.
Do you think everyone on the city council is as uninformed as it appears? Or could someone on the council know something that they are unable or unwilling to disclose?
The mayor has a couple council members that he is very, very close to, and I don't know if they have had conversations. I would think not. But I can only speak for myself, and I know I've had no conversations, nor have I attempted to have the conversation.
Jody Washington serves on the Lansing City Council. We're talking about the meeting late yesterday between members of council and the Bernero Administration Chief of Staff Randy Hannon about the rather generous severance package granted to former city attorney Janine McIntyre, $166,000.
On top of that, almost $10,000 worth of outside legal fees. So we're looking at, $175,000. And then, of course, I don't know if we're paying her COBRA for insurance for a year. I have no idea if that's in there. I would think when it's all said and done, it probably cost us more than that, probably closer to $200,000 when all of the expenses were brought into it. But Mark, understand too, we have no reasoning why this occurred, which of course makes it seem extremely unethical. But we also had recently the parachute package for Peter Lark. I believe that was $687,000. And we've never really gotten a clear answer as to why he was asked to leave. Clearly, it wasn't the ice storm because everybody sang his praises through that entire thing. 3 months earlier, he had an excellent performance review. And then all of a sudden, he was asked to leave and was given a huge amount of money. And I do believe there was, and this would have been before my time, but I believe there was another BWL director. So bad employment under this administration, either they were bad choices in hiring or there's something else going on, has cost the residents of this area $1 million. That's a lot of money.
I take it there was some discussion last night of the city council. Clarify this for me. I'm reading that there was discussion last night of the city council perhaps hiring attorneys at this point to help get to the bottom of this. Do you think that's going to happen?
I'm not sure. I think right now, from what I was able to garner from the conversations I overheard my colleagues having, is there's probably a 50-50 split on that request at this point. We have asked our chief deputy city attorney to share a memo with us, and my suspicion will be that memo says nothing. We have some colleagues that have said that, how can I say this? It's done. It's over. Let it go. It's throwing good money after bad.
These are people on the council you're talking about?
Yes. My problem with that is we have to ensure as a council that this stops. We cannot continue to let the administration go with things like that as saying it's done, it's over, move on. Because this could happen over and over again. When you see a mistake, I believe it is our responsibility when we're dealing with taxpayers' dollars to ensure that this never happens again. And there's the executive management agreements, the employment agreements that we discussed last night that was supposed to stop this padding with leave time to make these severance packages better. But this wasn't a severance package. This was a settlement agreement. And this money is being paid out of our claims and judgment fund. So it's not a severance package.
The city attorney, in theory at least, serves both the administration and the city council.
Correct.
Do I have that correct?
Correct.
The city now has a new interim city attorney, or is about to get a new city attorney. That's up in the air.
Maybe.
Mr. Abood has been proposed as an interim city attorney by the administration?
Correct.
Okay.
And that has not come before council for a vote to confirm that interim attorney.
You have to confirm that?
No, we don't. He can perform all the duties as chief deputy city attorney. I believe it's, I can't quote the charter here right now, but he would be able to perform all of the duties. My issue with this is I think Mr. Abood is a really good attorney, and he has served us well. But by his own admission, I have heard him say several times, I don't have the municipal experience. So my concern in confirming him as interim city attorney is that because things are done so shady in this city, that there will somehow be a way for the mayor to just push him in as city attorney without a good interview research process.
My original question was going to be, could you learn more from Mr. Abood if he's approved as city attorney? It sounds as if you're not terribly confident that you could.
Well, and he, too, is bound by the secrecy clause. So he can't share much, which is exactly why they had to go to outside law because of the conflict.
Could someone on the city council actually view the severance agreement here? I understand there was some confusion as to actually locating what was signed last night.
No, well, there was the confusion. We have the settlement agreement. We all have a copy of this settlement agreement, which says basically nothing, that she's leaving. Here's the money we are going to give her, and nobody can talk about this, and nobody can make any disparaging comments that might make the administration or Janine look bad. What we didn't have was her 2015 extension of her employment contract, and nobody seems to know where that is. And they're filed with the city clerk, and the city clerk said that he also looked in one other department head's file, and he doesn't have their 2015 agreement either.
City Council member Jody Washington of the Lansing City Council joins us here on Current State. Even Mayor Bernero wanted to end these golden parachute deals. He was a vocal critic of, he was a very vocal critic in the aftermath of the Peter Lark situation. Was the mayor over a barrel here for any reason? Is this lack of clarity really a result of him, or was he over a barrel and really had to cave and sign the severance agreement?
Who knows? Nobody knows what happened. Nobody can talk about it. Who knows why he was willing to make this deal in secrecy, and who knows why he was willing to give her this money and pad her leave account? We don't know. We have no answers, so I cannot answer that.
Does it concern you that this episode makes the council look really bad?
I don't think it makes us look bad at all. I think it makes the administration look bad. Why the need for secrecy? Why the need to pay her out? Why the need to have that? I don't believe that this is to say nobody will talk about it. If that's boilerplate language, get it out of there if you don't want people to ask the question of what are you hiding. It doesn't make us look bad. We had no knowledge.
You alluded earlier to the fact that the mayor has allies on the council.
He does.
Is there any chance that everyone on the council could learn more from those allies? Do you think those allies know more than you do?
I don't know. I don't know if they know more. I have to hope not, and I have to rely on their integrity. They didn't seem to want to ask the same types of questions that some of us were willing to ask, and yet they didn't seem to have any more information.
Are you hearing from constituents about this?
I am hearing from so many constituents about this. Very many.
And they are saying what?
They're angry. They are angry that nobody knows why she left. They are angry that their tax dollars are being paid for this, of what they view is probably foolishness. You know, we have to take care of our dollars. These are not Virge Bernero's dollars. These are the taxpayers' dollars.
You've been critical of the mayor in the past. Has this incident made you more of a critic?
Absolutely.
You also discussed pilots last night. We've got a limited amount of time left here, but this stands for payment in lieu of taxes, and this is another revenue-related issue. Can you frame what the discussion is about here?
Yeah, I'm a huge critic of the pilots in this city. What a pilot is payment in lieu of taxes, and it is used primarily for senior housing and low-income housing. Now, understand, Mark, I'm not against senior housing and low-income housing, but in Lansing, Michigan, we have way more than our fair share. And what this is I will talk about the Abigail project specifically. The developer wants to take that Abigail building and another building on the property and turn it into low-income senior housing. Then he wants to build 57-some units of low-income family units right next door to that Abigail building. Here's what a pilot is in this particular case. They take all of the rents that are actually paid. So if 50% of the units are empty, they don't pay for those units. They only take the rent that is actually paid for that year.
Got it.
They back out all of their expenses for utilities, electric, water, sewage, et cetera. They back all of that out, and then we get 4% of what's left. My argument is this. One, we have way too many on the books already that most of them don't end until 2030, 2033. I say we have more than our fair share of low-income housing in this city anyway. We don't need to be the hub. This needs to be a regional discussion, and outlying areas need to have their own. But my problem with the pilot is, so not only do we get only 4% of practically nothing because the rents are low, because they're low-income housing, we also get no income tax from this particular population.
It's a revenue crunch.
Revenue issue for me. And the problem with it is that we have too much, and they're putting them in an already challenged neighborhood. I detest concentrated poverty. And we aren't in a position to continue to give our land away for 50 years for 4% of nothing. We can't do it. We need revenue.
We are out of time. We have to let our guest go, and we appreciate her presence here an awful lot. Jody Member serves on the Lansing City Council. Thanks very much. Coming up on Current State, the human health impacts of the Flint water crisis are serious, but animals also face the risk of lead poisoning, and many Flint residents are now using bottled water to feed their cats and dogs. We visit a church where MSU veterinarians are doing lead tests for Flint pets and advising their owners on how to keep them healthy if they've been exposed. That's on the way on Current State. Well, for MSU fans who are still upset about Friday's loss, we have something that might distract you from the anguish. Instead of March Madness, try Small Town Madness. The Lansing State Journal reader poll brackets Michigan's best towns of fewer than 6,000 people, puts them into categories, and pits them against each other to see who emerges victorious. Round one is over. The voting for round two closes tonight at 11 p.m., so there's still time to cast your votes. Lansing State Journal reporter Kathleen Levy is here to tell us about who's still in the running and fill us in on some of the details about these great little Michigan towns. Welcome to Current State, Kathleen.
Hello.
As a guy who grew up in a small mid-Michigan town, I'm pleased you're doing. I'm a sucker for all things small townish.
Well, and I am also from a small Michigan town, and my sister is a village president of Pinckney right now. And she saw our list of 16, and she's like,
what?
Something is missing.
Doesn't the family connection count for anything here, she says. So how many categories of competition do you have?
Well, we started out last week with 16 towns, and we have four categories of competition. We have a beach bracket. And as you can imagine, it was very difficult to narrow down the towns that go in the beach bracket. Actually, it was really kind of difficult to narrow them all down. We have a Uper and North bracket with some of our favorite very northern towns. There is a hip and artsy bracket and a historic, quaint, and charming bracket.
So let's talk about the towns in the running for the best beach towns here. Which four beach towns started off in round one?
Okay, the four beach towns that we started with were Frankfort, South Haven, East Tawas, and Saugatuck.
And which two came out on top?
The two that came out on top for now, we now have a battle going on between South Haven and Saugatuck.
Okay. And let me see. What recommends each of those? See, I know Saugatuck a little bit better than I know South Haven here. What recommends each one of those towns?
Well, you know, they both have a fantastic vibe, but they're a little bit different of a vibe. You know, Saugatuck kind of has that cosmopolitan edge.
Indeed.
They've got arts and fine dining and kind of a very hip vibe, whereas South Haven is a little more laid back, with a big kind of much more family kind of vibe and just kind of a more laid back effort. So it really depends on how you like your beautiful Lake Michigan beach.
So Agatok's got a Venetian festival as well. And South Haven has a number of things. It's got a lighthouse. It's got a number of things to recommend it. Can you share with us who leads in the voting right now there in the
beach
competition?
I can tell you, actually, I am looking at the beach bracket. I just looked these up this morning. And right now, South Haven is ahead. They have 54% of the vote. And Saugatuck has 46% of the vote. Mm. So here is your chance to make a difference by going to lsj.com and voting here. You can still get your favorite to the top.
Saugatuck enthusiasts have been issued a challenge here, I guess. The next category is Best Artsy Town. Saugatuck could be in that category as well. As it turned out, there's some overlap that you probably had to contend with.
There is. We sort of had to make a choice on some of these. And Charlevoix could have been a beach town, too. So what we have going in the Hip and Arty is a contest between Charlevoix and Chelsea.
Ooh,
right now.
Nice choices.
And there are some, of course, fantastic things about both of these towns. Chelsea is a particular favorite of mine because of its proximity to my hometown of Pinckney. And it is very much, you know, that kind of cosmopolitan vibe. They've got great food. They've got great theater. Lots of fun, and also the Jiffy Mix plant. What is not to like?
Exactly. Who's winning that competition right now? Or leading it
right now. Charlevoix has the edge. They have about 55% of the vote, and Chelsea has about 45% of the vote. So that is another race that could go either way.
I'm thinking, you know, we have so much fondness for up north in this part of the state. I'm almost wondering if the locations that are up north just have kind of a built-in advantage.
I think they might have a slight edge, and we did see that. We did see that where some of our southern towns went out in the first round in favor of the great memories that we have of the northern ones.
Sure. I'm speaking with Kathleen Levy of the Lansing State Journal about the Small Town Madness Bracketology. It's a contest to determine the best small towns in Michigan. You can vote at lansingstatejournal.com. Voting ends tonight at 11 p.m. You wrote that the tightest race of all was in the first round for the best Upper and North town. Which two towns were close there?
The two towns that were close in our first round were Houghton Lake and Gaylord. And only two votes separated them in the voting. And we had thousands of votes. So this does show that every vote matters. And, you know, I love Houghton Lake. I love Gaylord, too. Those towns really have that very classic up north feel.
They do.
And so, interestingly enough, in the current round, we have...
Gaylord prevailed, I understand.
Gaylord prevailed, and they have gone on to take on Munising head-to-head. And this is also our tightest current race, with Gaylord has 51% of the vote and Munising has 49% of the vote. And this is a super tough one for me because I love Munising, too. I love Pictured Rocks. I love everything about the vibe of that part of the UP. So this is a really tough choice to make.
And who's leading right now?
Well, Gaylord is ahead by 2%. So...
2% of,
2%
the, of the overall vote.
Correct.
You've got a category as well for best historic, quaint, and charming town. And round two here has Eaton Rapids in our backyard facing off against Frankenmuth. Which towns did they beat out?
Well, Eaton Rapids, hold on, I have to check my notes here. Eaton Rapids beat Sheboygan, which is a fun and pleasant town. And Frankenmuth beat Portland, which is a very hip and trendy, kind of fun little town also, and quaint and charming, and of course still getting over the tornado that they had earlier this year.
See, no, I don't think of Portland as quaint and charming. To tell, maybe it's been too long since I've been there. I don't know.
You know, they have some neat things going on. They have this Riverwalk trail that kind of goes through town. They've got some fun downtown businesses. And they have really kind of come together in their Portland Strong way since the tornado last summer. So I think Portland has a little bit, it's very cool. But, however, unfortunately, they're out.
It's Eaton Rapids versus Frankenmuth. Does the fact that you're the Lansing State Journal give Eaton Rapids the edge here?
Well, right now it seems that it does because Eaton Rapids and Frankenmuth are running neck and neck, 50-50 right now. So this is another one that could go either way. That's kind of the super fun thing about this round is that all of these races are close enough that we can tip them in a final surge of voting today.
And when will you announce the winners tomorrow?
Yep, that will be tomorrow. Yep, tomorrow sometime before noon.
You've enjoyed a pretty good response to this thing. Do people respond to this kind of...
They do. I think people love something where they can vote online, and the kind of the one of the fun things about this is that after you vote, it shows you how the voting is going, so you can kind of see if other people thought the same way that you did or not, and that also kind of gives you if you want to rally behind somebody, then you can kind of get everybody out and.
Well, I imagine it also provokes people. I'm sitting here thinking I need to learn more about Portland. And I need to learn more about Sheboygan. You know, it's been a long time since I've been to Sheboygan. It's been a while since I've been to Portland, and it's right nearby. I think it might trigger people's curiosity about, maybe I need to learn more about what's going on.
And this is exactly what I hoped for when we did this. You know, I am a Michigan homer. I'm a fifth generation Michigan, and I have been all over the state. And there are so many towns that are so interesting and so quaint and so charming, and there's so much beach, and there's so much wonderful stuff that I just really was kind of hoping that people would say, hey, I haven't been to Eaton Rapids in a long time. Let's go and see what's down there. You know, and they do a lot of fun things in Eaton Rapids.
No, you're right. You make a great point. Well, I'm so glad you did this. Gotta love anything involving Michigan's small towns. I've been speaking with Kathleen Levy of the Lansing State Journal about the Small Town Madness Bracket to determine the best small towns in Michigan. You can vote at lansingstatejournal.com. The voting ends tonight at 11. Kathleen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And coming up on Current State, 13 students from the China Conservatory of Music are currently in East Lansing and about to mount an operatic production with their student counterparts from Michigan State. We'll take you behind the scenes for this landmark 10th year of a unique cultural exchange. That and more after the break on Current State. Every Tuesday, we let a Current State staffer share a bit of new music with listeners. This week's is from producer Katie Cook. Katie, what do you have?
I picked a song by Andrew Bird called Capsized. It's a single from his upcoming album, Are You Serious?, which comes out April 1st.
Now when you wake up, night's falling, someone is by your side. Pull it together, darling, you're not alone. But when you break up, sky's falling, no one is on your side. Spoon to the laundry, darling, you're all alone. And when you wake up, another sunrise, another breakup, ship is capsized. And when you wake up, another sunrise.
What do you like about Andrew Bird?
I really appreciate artists who write their own songs, and Andrew Bird is not only a singer-songwriter, but he can play a lot of different instruments. He plays violin primarily, but also guitar, glockenspiel, and he's known for his whistling. In this song, he holds his violin like a guitar and plays it that way, which is kind of cool.
The song is Capsized by Andrew Bird. Thanks, Katie.
Sure, Mark.
Now he's a dandy. He's a done bit maker. Jesus gonna make my
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thank you for joining us today. From nausea to brain damage, the effects of lead poisoning can touch almost every system in the body. Children who are exposed to lead are more likely to have developmental delays and behavioral problems later on. That's why public health leaders are rallying around kids in Flint right now. There are nutrition programs and pushes to expand early childhood education to try and mitigate some of the damage done by the city's lead-tainted drinking water. But while children's health is rightfully the top priority in the city, humans aren't the only ones who were exposed to lead in the drinking water. Current state producer April Van Buren brings us a story about an effort to help Flint's four-legged residents during the water crisis.
For a lot of us, pets are a part of our family. Our cats and dogs sit in on our holiday photo shoots. They take up half the bed at night and hide their toys behind every piece of furniture. When they're sick, it can be nerve-wracking. That's the situation many Flint pet owners find themselves in right now. The lead-tainted water that filled the glasses of city residents also filled the water bowls of their cats and dogs. And that's left many in Flint worried about the health of their furry companions. Which is what brings me here, to the basement of St. Paul's Episcopal Church. Staff from the MSU College of Veterinary Medicine are here to test pets from around the community for lead exposure. Seamus, a black and white pit bull mix, is next in line. Vet tech Monica Ranke dons gloves and gets the needle ready.
We're just going to set him down against the wall so he can't back up away from us. And then she's just going to hold his head up for me and move his collar out of the way. We're drawing from their jugular vein. Most dogs tolerate it really well.
I have to say, Seamus is remarkably calm for a dog that's about to be poked in the neck with a needle. He sits patiently on the yoga mat laid out on the floor as Monica preps him for the blood draw.
So we put a little bit of alcohol over the vessel, and then I'm going to hold off his vessel with my other hand. Good boy. Good boy, stay.
She draws around 10 milliliters of blood and puts it into four separate vials before sending Seamus off with a treat.
Good boy. You want that?
Seamus is one of over 100 dogs that have been tested by MSU so far. Assistant Professor Dr. Daniel Langua is leading the effort. He says events like this one are helping with an unmet need in the community.
Well, I think a giant focus so far has been on human health, and it rightfully should be, but at the same time, the pet dogs and cats in the community, they were drinking the same exact water sources that people were, and they have the exact same potential for exposure and toxicity as well. And so we just wanted to make sure that they were not being forgotten in this crisis.
Dr. Langua says he organized the free test after hearing from people who were worried when they realized their pets had been lapping up lead-tainted water. People like Andrea Consiglio, whose dog Seamus you just met.
He showed up on my porch December of 2012. I told him to go home, and he said, I am.
Andrea says before she found out about the lead in the water, her whole family, including Seamus and her 9 cats, were all drinking tap water.
We all were. And honestly, I feel bad because when I switched over to drinking the filtered, I was still, you know, just mindlessly filling theirs up because I have a big 5-gallon. I was just mindlessly filling it up from the tap.
After one of her cats began losing its fur, Andrea switched to bottled water for everyone in her house. Dr. Lane Gua says the signs of lead poisoning in pets are similar to what you'd see in humans.
And it depends on the amount of exposure and how long it's been going on, but we can see gastrointestinal signs, so vomiting, diarrhea, decreased appetite. We can also see a variety of neurologic signs, so some dogs might have behavioral changes, aggression, or even depression for that matter, and in some severe cases you can even see seizures.
Luckily, they haven't found lead in most of the animals they've tested so far. Just 3 dogs have shown high levels of the neurotoxin. But Dr. Langua says lead doesn't always show up in blood samples. It can migrate to other parts of the animal's body, like the bones. And its long-term effects might not show up for years.
Yeah, there's absolutely developmental effects that may be delayed before we see signs of them too. And so just like in humans, the animals that are most likely to be affected are the young puppies and kittens.
For those animals that do test positive for lead, Dr. Langua says there are treatment options to help mitigate the damage.
The main thing is just to remove the source of exposure, and whether that's drinking water, that's switching over to a bottled source or filtered water, and then providing a really well-balanced, complete diet, which will help offset some of the effects of that. If the levels are really high, there are actually medications that we can give that will help bind the lead in the body and get it eliminated quicker. And so that's reserved, though, for select cases with really high levels.
Among the pit bulls and poodles running around the church today, there is one pet that sticks out. Blackie the cat sits on the lap of 80-year-old Flint resident Joe Whiteside. Joe says he has lots of friends and family in the area, but it's Blackie who he spends most of his time with.
Oh, he loves me. He sleeps with me every night and color with me. He gets up and looks for my wife, but she's dead, and just him and I.
It's clear Joe adores this cat. He's even dressed him in a tiny cat-sized Florida Gators hoodie to keep him warm on this chilly March day. Every week, Joe walks to the water station to pick up bottles for himself and his feline buddy.
I were buying it at the store before, you know, they had it out for everybody to just come get it everywhere now. And I have plenty stacked in my house. We don't drink it. We don't buy. We take baths in it, the water we get in the bottle. We don't mess with that faucet water.
Andrea Consiglio isn't sure if she'll ever be able to trust the water that comes out of her faucet. She says she was angry when she found out it took the state of Michigan almost a year and a half to realize lead was leaching into the city's drinking water.
I had actually just come back from a mission trip to Haiti, where you can't drink the water if you're from the States because it's, you know, so different, and you have to filter and do bottled, and to come back home to really the richest country in the nation, or in the world, excuse me, and find out that this was happening and people knew about it. So now when they tell me that it's safe, I don't know what it's going to take for me to believe them.
Until she does, she's sticking to bottled water for both her and Seamus. For Current State, this is April Van Buren.
This segment's supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. We can all get a little stuck in our ways sometimes, but every once in a while something comes along and changes our mind. The storytellers at Pop-Up Stories earlier this month spent some time remembering their own changes of heart, and we've got a snippet from that show for you today. Here's one of our esteemed storytellers, Drew.
So the setup for this is I grew up on the west side of the state, idyllic, perfect childhood, mom, dad. I was the oldest of 2.4 kids. But a mile outside of town was Grandma and Aunt Stevie's old farmstead. Now, Grandma and Aunt Stevie are just the best grandparents that there ever were. Grandma, on Saturdays, would haul my scrawny butt over to Saugatuck, and we'd paint with all the creative people over there. Aunt Stevie, old farm girl, she could cook like you would not believe her. She was a crack shot with her pistol. Greatest grandparents in the world. Well, when I turned 18, I got out of school 6 months early, had enough credits, good job. And right after that, my mom died sitting on the couch right next to me. My dad went a little crazy. I guess I probably did too in retrospect. Moved out into the woods in a trailer with a bunch of my reprobate friends and did what we reprobates did in the 70s. Some of it might have even been legal. But I could always, Grandma and Aunt Stevie never changed. They were always in the old farmstead a mile outside of town. One time I went out there and there were a bunch of cars in the old ring around driveway that I didn't recognize. I went in because you don't knock at Grandma's house. And there were a bunch of gay, obviously gay men, sitting in the living room, drinking. They were playing music, and they were laughing up a storm, and they were just having a great time. Now, I knew they were gay men because I was 18, and therefore the smartest person in the world, right? But, shoot, there's all these gay men in Grandma's house. I've got to warn her, don't I? So I found some excuse to take Grandma into the laundry room. Grandma, I think all your friends out there are gay. She patted me on the head. I had a lot more hair back then. It was the 70s. She says, it's okay, dear. They're our friends. I says, Grandma, I don't think you understand. Do you know what gay means? And I'll never forget her answer. She put her hands gently on my face and looked me square in the eye. Yes, she said, it means that you've found someone that you love. Thank you.
We've got another Pop-Up Stories coming event event coming up this Thursday evening. Remember, join us at the Broad Art Museum from 6 to 7:30 p.m. We'll have a great lineup of storytellers who'll be talking about their lucky break. You can find more information on our Facebook page. Just search Pop-Up Stories Lansing. Hope to see you there. This week, 13 special guests will be at the Fairchild Theater on the MSU campus. They are students of the China Conservatory of Music, and they'll be singing alongside 13 students from the MSU College of Music. It's part of a cultural exchange between the two universities, and Current State's Jamie Paisley sat in on several rehearsals this past weekend to learn more about the collaboration. Sounds like fun.
Well, sure. I mean, they're all looking for their lucky break as well.
Right? Exactly.
This show, it's, you know, on this side of the hemisphere, it's being helmed by MSU Professor Melanie Helton, and it's split down the middle. And what I mean by that is that the MSU side of the collaboration, they've pulled together a kind of review of music by Leonard Bernstein, great, you know, great composer.
Of course.
And the first half, however, was selected by the China Conservatory of Music and is rather a popular Mandarin language one-act opera by Jin Xiang, which is a tale of revenge, really suitable for either a traditional, you know, Western opera like Verdi, or maybe a Quentin Tarantino film. That opera is called The Savage Land.
It's a cut version of it, but as you've heard, it's quite dramatic. It's sort of Puccini meets China on steroids. And we cut the dead baby, so it's quite a melodramatic barn burner.
This is a 10-year collaboration. Mm-hmm. How did that collaboration start?
Well, my colleague Richard Fracker totally began, and it's his baby, with his friend Hai Jing Fu. They had sung at the Metropolitan Opera together for many years, done lots of productions, and they were both teaching at the same time as performing. So they thought, wouldn't it be great to get their students together from Chinese conservatories and MSU? And so that's how it began. We have to have an invitation letter from the Chinese government that specifically states where we're going to stay. We all use a firm that's in Chicago that basically, we'll take your visa application to the consulate for you for a fee, and it all gets done very easily. And it's relatively expensive, but it's relatively easy.
Yeah. How many students in total went over?
13, and 4 faculty this time.
And then how many people are coming over from China as well?
Well, 13 students. There are 3 faculty here already. We believe there are 2 voice teachers coming over with the Chinese students. The exciting bit about this trip was we actually did one performance in the National Performing Arts Center in Beijing, which is literally to the back of Tiananmen Square. If you Google it, it's the most magnificent building. It looks like a giant egg on a reflecting pond. It's about 14 city blocks. All I know is when we went into one side and we had to walk to the other, it took us about 25 minutes. A beautiful concert hall, packed house at 10:30 on a Saturday morning for an educational thing. Lots of kids. So it was really a very exciting thing for our students to be able to sing with a big orchestra on that beautiful stage.
Naturally, one of the things Professor Melanie Helton and the entire company of MSU College of Music and China Conservatory of Music focused upon was pronunciation, which when it comes to singing is quite different from everyday speech.
Our students worked very, very hard with Zaiquan Song, who is one of our doctoral students who happens to be an alum of our project originally and is now here doing graduate work as a result of that collaboration. They also worked with Leah Wang, who's one of our doctoral pianists who comes from China as well. And so they worked very, very hard. They got, you know, audio tapes and listened and sort of a, you can't really do a normal phonetic alphabet on it. So you sort of do phonetic alphabet plus your own, whatever your own sort of shorthand is, and they just practiced and practiced, and Zaiquan made faces at them when they didn't do it right. And the good news is that the Chinese audiences responded very, very well. They did laugh at a couple places, but I was told it was more out of delight from the Americans actually giving a pretty good stab at the Mandarin rather than them saying something like, I'm going to the store, rather than, you killed my father.
I'm Skylar Sheltron. I'm a second-year master's student studying voice performance at Michigan State University's College of Music.
And this was not the first trip that you recently took.
No, this is actually my third trip. Yeah, so first was 2012, then 2014, and now 2016.
For your trip over there, did you learn any phrases?
Sure. Hi, of course. Ni hao. Thank you. Xie xie. Actually, yes is shi, and no is bu. And you'll hear no a lot in the opera.
And you're using your fingers as you're doing that as well to indicate the different directions.
Yes, it's hard not to now at this point to indicate the inflection, because that was kind of how Zaiquan would teach us. Like, the third tone is like V shape. So then he would do it and we'd be like, oh, okay, we get it. In the first few rehearsals, we decided to mix up the casts, which is what we'll be doing here. There will be half the cast American, half Chinese. It was a little, you know, the language barrier was a little tough at first. But then coming together on the piece and coming together with the music, we were able to get to know each other as performers, and there was a little bit of trust built there. You know, my character's lover is now the Chinese baritone. So it was really cool to be able to come together and to have an understanding and to be able to try different things with that person as a performer, and then seeing that come into our lives, you know, trusting and getting to know each other and feeling better about speaking and trying to speak each other's languages. So it was, yeah, a cool process. There were some rehearsals that were a little rough. Just a gesture as small as like a little clutch of your hand or a hug, things like that, to be able to say you can do this, is it means the world to both parts.
After the first act of The Savage Land, the second half of this MSU College of Music, China Conservatory of Music collaboration is a review of theatrical music by Leonard Bernstein. And according to Professor Melanie Helton, the linguistic acrobatics of English lyrics did shape the song selected.
Well, some of the things we had to make sure that we're going to play in China regardless. So some of the talkier things we haven't included. We've got a nice selection from West Side Story. We have I Feel Pretty and Maria and then the Tonight duet, the balcony scene. And from On the Town, we have New York, New York, which is the famous opening. And a little-known piece from Wonderful Town called Quiet Girl, which has become one of my favorites. It's for a baritone, and then there are four male backup singers as it goes on, and it's a Sinatra tune, if there ever was one. Although the Chinese had never heard of Frank Sinatra's, so I thought he was pretty much worldwide, but but I guess I'm old. The English, by and large, was quite good. There were certain things that some of them struggled with. Got to see the whole town right from Yonkers on down to the bay. Gave the tenor Cheng Chu a little bit of problem, but he's got it now. And he worked really hard. Sometimes it's just a matter of getting sort of nose-to-nose with them and letting them watch your mouth. Because the Chinese language never closes to N. Anything that closes in, like if you say spoken or ringing, those are hard sounds for them because their language doesn't include anything that closes to N.
My name is Xinmu Cao, and my English is Coco, and I'm from China Conservatory of Music, and I was born in Dalian, or Liaoning province of China.
Have you done this exchange before?
No, this is the first time of me,
okay.
Yes.
And how is singing in English? Have you done much of that before?
A little, because in China Conservatory of Music, we also sing many pieces of Italian, German, and French, but a little about English. But I have sung some musical theaters as English. We always talk about our things, yes, and I think we also can teach each other, and I can hear their singing, and I will have more thought of my singing.
Yeah. And I know when last week in China when you were performing, mm-hmm. it was just a stage, but now you have kind of the background
mm-hmm, yeah.
there. Is that a very interesting change for you?
Yes, I'm very excited. Yes, because I have never sing in the theater, just in the musical hall, yes. I have more space on the stage, and yeah, I think it's very exciting things.
Especially Glitter and Begay is just you. There's no background at all as well, right?
Yes, I think it's a challenge, and I think I'm very happy and very excited now.
Well, we all come together for the last piece, every single person. So there's 26 of us singing this really beautiful Bernstein piece that's just so warming. And that's kind of the ending piece has been like the pinnacle of all of the collaborations thus far. Every collaboration, we come together on a piece at the end. And you know, when you're staging it at first, it's kind of like hold hands, look happy. But you know, when you're really doing it, it really does become something bigger than us.
The Savage Land and Bernstein Sings America. This collaboration between the MSU College of Music and the China Conservatory of Music begins Wednesday the 23rd and runs through Sunday the 27th. Tickets and more information are available online at music.msu.edu. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow, the Lansing State Journal's Eric Lacey joins us to revisit Mayor Virge Bernero's State of the City address tonight at NioWave. The House of Promise is a faith-based nonprofit that assists survivors of sex abuse and sex trafficking. We'll speak with its president and founder, Sherry Montgomery. And actor-director Timothy Busfield visits East Lansing today to discuss the future of storytelling with MSU students and faculty. We'll ask Busfield what that future looks like and about his spouse, Melissa Gilbert, and her candidacy for Congress from Michigan. All of that and more Wednesday here on Current State. You can connect with us on social media, on Twitter. Find us at KAR Current State. On Facebook, it's Current State from WKAR. We hope to see you on Wednesday. It's Current State from WKAR.